As the Earth passes the tipping point of 1.5 degrees Celsius and slides into floods, droughts, melting ice caps, and the mass extinction of species, many of us are trying to reckon with feelings of anxiety and despair. The science is crystal clear, and yet the fossil fuel companies continue to drill for more and more oil. How do we navigate the climate emergency and come to terms with the catastrophic consequences of humanity's inaction? How do we remain engaged in working to make a difference? Is there still hope? Could you use a guide to the end of the world as we know it? In his new book, I Want a Better Catastrophe, Navigating the Climate Crisis with Grief, Hope, and Gallows Humor, veteran activist, thinker, doer, storyteller, and CEO of The Climate Clock, my guest, Andrew Boyd, navigates between the denial and doom many of us feel to find a third way of approaching our situation, courageously facing the data and its ramifications, and helping people imagine what's still possible and where we might still exercise agency. You may be thinking, oh no, this is going to be depressing. But my guest, Andrew Boyd, brings wit, wisdom, and gallows humor to our existential questions. This is Aspire with Osha, Art, Nature, Humanity, and I'm your host, Osha Hayden. Welcome to the show, Andrew Boyd.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here, Osha. And what three better things could you subtitle your show with than Art, Nature, and Humanity? Wonderful. Yeah.
That's kind of my thinking. In your quest to understand how we deal with the existential angst of facing the climate emergency, you interviewed 8 leading climate thinkers, and you heard a whole range of answers. But can you talk a little bit about what you learned?
Yeah, so the book is a journey. The book is a quest. The book is a sort of exploration. After having a lifelong activist, the last 10 of those years focused on climate and having found that hope has powered me through many, many struggles, many causes, sometimes to victory. But with the climate breakdown, tackling that question felt like the usual kind of basic optimism-driven hope was not sufficient to the task. That climate catastrophe, I came to realize after working in the movement to try to address it and reading literature and that it was no longer a problem we could fix, but a predicament we had to face and survive and navigate and learn to, you know, mitigate, but that we would never sort of fix it or not in our lifetimes and in our next several generations, fix it in a way that it went away, that it was going to be with us. So it required a different orientation. And so I went in search of wisdom for what that orientation is. People who could have a clear-eyed acknowledgement of the hole that we were in, of the trouble we were in for, in the decades to come, but have a hopeful, helpful, ethical, spiritual, grounded, sane way of facing into that uncertain and possibly very treacherous future. So I talked to a diverse array of people across America. Amongst the, you know, there were more than the 8 that you mentioned, but those were the 8 that ended up as the full transcripts of the interviews and my own digesting of their wisdom and integrating it into the threads of the book in it. And they included a climate activist, Tim DeChristopher, who's famous for an incredible act of creative bravery to protect pristine Red Rock Country in Utah from oil and gas drilling, which landed him 2 years in a federal penitentiary, and then a powerful speech in defense of civil disobedience and all the good that it has brought America throughout its history. And then he went to Harvard Divinity School, and he's written and spoken very eloquently about his whole journey of despair through reckoning with our climate truth, if you will, and how he landed in a place of resilience and hope and continued action. And he had a couple things to offer that were very notable to me, which one was the way that action for him was a coping mechanism. Action is what kept him sane and grounded and balanced. And he used the metaphor of a bicycle. It's only when pedaling the bicycle that you find your balance, you know? So It's like, for him, that was a good description of how being engaged with the problem, even if it's in some ways an impossible problem, was a spiritual, a warrior spiritual position that allowed him to live in his truth and live in a very grounded way, live in good faith with the historical moment and with himself. It's a person who can't lie, can't tell himself a lie. So that was the way he could live with himself. by telling the truth, no holds barred, and then engaging to try to do everything that he could to make it, to address the problem. So that was one thing. And then he also said he had a very interesting definition for him, or understanding of hope, not the kind of notion that a lot of us use of where we're just clutching our lottery ticket and sitting on the couch and hoping it all comes out well and kind of thing. But rather for him, it was not based on a good outcome. What he calls, it's not a fragile optimism-based hope. That's not going to serve us in the dark times that we're entering into, but rather has to be more a resilient kind of hope. And he defines it as hope for him was the will. First of all, that's interesting. It's very verb, not noun, right? The will to hold on to your values in the face of difficulty. It just felt like that just was a revelation to me to think of hope in that way. So that was one thing I learned. I spoke with one of the leading voices in the environmental justice and climate justice movement. Lives in Oakland, Gopal Dayaneni. He's part of an incredible collective near where you're based, you know, in Oakland, California.
Right.
Called the Movement Generation. You could think of it as a backyard think tank, community-based think tank, which is, I think, just a beautiful way to think about it. And they've developed some very, very powerful models of transitioning from an extractive economy to a regenerative economy in all many realms or sectors of society and economy. And he acknowledged, you know, these are people, I wanted to speak with people who weren't pretending things were better than they are, but were still bringing their best selves forward, right? Not retreating into despair or fake optimism kind of thing. You know, one of his takeaways, or one of the takeaways I took away from my conversation about so many different things with him was, and he said, we're going to suffer. Accept that piece of it. So how do we distribute that suffering most equitably? We're in for suffering. And the way we can suffer the least, even those of us with the most privilege, the way we can suffer the least is if that suffering is distributed most equitably. And then the people most vulnerable aren't suffering the most. And we're all bearing this burden together. And we're pulling together as a species, as a society, as a community to tackle this and centering justice as we face the challenges. That's not a new perspective, but he was an extremely powerful messenger of it with all else that he brought. And I thought that that encapsulation was just a very striking way to think about it.
One thing I wanted to say about that is that makes a lot of sense, because our hearts are breaking as we watch, you know, the species dying and going extinct, knowing that it was in our hands, and now it's not. We've passed that point. And so our hearts are breaking as we watch that, and we watch the plants dying and trees dying and animals dying. And so it seems to me, if we can at least hold the others of our species, other human beings, close and try to help each other as we go through this, at least that is something that we can do that is beautiful and has meaning.
I'm 110% giving you exactly. I think that's a very powerful perspective. It's a spiritual attitude, if you will, and an ethical one. We do what's right because it's right, not because we're promised a certain outcome. We're acting with compassion and care and kindness and solidarity, not just for our own species, but for our brother, sister, you know, a genderless species. And yeah, I also sat down with Adrienne Marie Brown, who I imagine some of your listeners are aware of, in her book, Emergent Strategy, her book, Pleasure Activism. She's an organizational healer, an innovator in visionary fiction, you know, and wears many different hats and is an extremely innovative thinker and feeler. She's deeply in her body and twins the intellectual and felt dimensions of this, and based in Detroit now, was in the Bay Area for a while. But one of the most poignant things that anyone said in any of the interviews was her notion she shared, which was this question or this invitation or this spiritual instruction, if you will, that she offered, which was, you know, we're in for a hard fall. Once again, acknowledging where we're at in history's big cycle. We're in for a big fall. So how do we fall, you know, as if we were holding a child on our chest and falling backwards? How do we go through the rough stuff that's coming in a way that protects those that we most love, the places we most love, the people we most love, for some, the other species that we most love, those who are most vulnerable, and how do we protect them?
That is a very, very powerful, powerful image right there. And it, I think, brings that sense that of, you know, not just for you, but for, and not just for your own child, but for all the children to come. It's that holding them, protecting them. I feel that all the time, really. And there was a really wonderful book by Richard Powers called Bewilderment that is about the climate crisis. I recommend that people read that one too. But the first book they really need to read is this book right here.
Oh,
I Want a Better Catastrophe, Navigating the Climate Crisis with Grief, Hope, and Gallows Humor. I have to say, Andrew, that this book was an eye-opener for me, and it's brilliant. You have lots of charts and graphs in there as well.
There's a few, yeah.
It's brilliant, and it really gives people a place. If you're falling, it gives you like a little handhold to grab onto so that you might be able to save yourself from falling on the rocky crags below. So
thank you.
To That's say that, I recommend this book.
Oh.
And the other thing that was important about it is that, like right up front at the beginning, you really get to where we are.
Yeah.
In terms of the truth of where we are, that even a number of scientists don't really want to admit because they're afraid, what will we do? Well, if we tell people, what will they do? How will they respond? Will they just quit trying? Will they just give up? And so I think that's really important because you're taking that issue and you're answering kind of that question of the scientists, what will they do if they know the truth? And you're laying it out there is that, okay, we need to know the truth. As you say, clear eyes and full hearts, open hearts.
Right. Pulled from Friday Night Lights, you know. The book visits some dilemmas that I think readers find that they maybe have been nursing sourly in the corner of their own souls, but then they're very recognizable just by articulating them. People at the events, I've been doing this book tour, about to head to the West Coast on Sunday and doing events in your neck of the woods, the Bay Area and Marin, both sides of the Bay, et cetera. But people at the events, like, oh yeah, last night, you know, they're talking the next day, I get a little text message or something. It was intense. It was heavy. I mean, we mixed the laughter in with the serious truth telling, as you say, but then people said, and I woke up energized. We absolutely must do something about this. And I am personally inspired and motivated to do all that I can. It's like trusting your audience. It's understandable that the scientists who are getting the first glimmers of this bad news, they're not trained as grief counselors, right? They're trained as scientists, and we need them to be scientists, right? But they're in this role of, because they're the first responders in a way. They're not the first responders, but the first ones to sort of know the latest. So there's a lot of anxiety they have about, you know, am I just going to depress people? Am I going to demobilize people? You know, the book takes up these various dilemmas and doesn't always answer them, decides to bring the truth forward pretty hard, but then hold people in that grief and hold people in like, well, what am I supposed to do? Here's some things.
And
it makes sense that we have that dilemma, and the book just helps people recognize and step through the dilemma and decide where they want to land on that and feel okay in being torn, like having, you know, being torn in different directions. It's okay. We all are.
Well, let's take a short break, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're speaking with Andrew Boyd, author of I Want a Better Catastrophe. We'll be back in just a moment. In case you're just joining us, this is Aspire with Osha, Art, Nature, Humanity, and I'm your host, Osha Hayden. I am here with Andrew Boyd, author of the new book, I Want a Better Catastrophe, Navigating the Climate Crisis with Grief, Hope, and Gallows Humor. So we were just talking, yes, we were just talking about how important it is for people to be exposed to the truth of our predicament. And you do talk about that, the difference between a problem and a predicament. Because a problem you can cure, you can fix, but a predicament, you just have to figure out a way to deal with it, to maneuver with it, to navigate
it less,
around it,
right? Make it navigate, make it less worse. There are ways to make it less worse.
Make it less
worse. Can't quite make it go away. I think that's mm-hmm. a little bit of the critical difference there.
And so you talk about the difference between hope and optimism.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Want to say more about that?
Yeah. Just to be fair to the many people I talk to, I think people mean different things by these words, hope, optimism, faith. And people mean many different things by these various words. And so one person's hope might be another person's optimism, faith, et cetera. So I just noticed that. I just want to acknowledge that. And I think the critical distinction is between an outcome-based motivating ethos and where the outcome, where you're doing what's right because it's right, not because think you're promised a good outcome. So that's, I think, a little bit of how many number of the people I spoke with distinguish between optimism and hope. Optimism is more fragile. Optimism depends on a good result. And hope is more of something you do out of an ethos, an act of will, an ethical commitment.
It's process versus goal in a way.
In a way, yeah. Or a goal-dependent attitude and versus doing something because of your character and calling, if you will. I also learned that there's many kinds of hope, right? We think we're either hopeful or hopeless. But that's a false binary. There's actually many ways to be hopeful. They, in a sense, allow you to do different things, or that they allow you to either sustain your hope or slip into pessimism because it's not as grounded in your fullness of the situation or the fullness of yourself. And I could read a short passage. I don't know if that's how
That'd
your show
great.
Works, which sort of talks about a few different kinds of hope and this critical distinction between optimism and hope, if you will. So this is in a whole chapter called Is There Hope? And it's the first piece. It references and lauds Rebecca Solnit, another famous resident of your region of the country, Rebecca Solnit, and her very beloved, very short, beautiful, poignant work that she wrote 20 years ago called Hope in the Dark. It's a very beautiful work. And 20 years later, I'm titling my little piece of this chapter called Hope in the Like Really Dark, just as a sort of homage and a riff on her. So I'll just note that it begins with this beautiful quote from, or very instructive quote from Raymond Williams, who's a British literary theorist, blah, blah, blah. But he says, this is an important instruction, I think, that I tried to take seriously. To be truly radical is to make hope possible, not despair convincing. There's enough data out there to make despair convincing. You know, that's sort of an easy job. That's a punter's job. But it's much harder and much more necessary to make hope possible. So that's a sort of instruction that the little chapter begins with. So this is like a little page of text here. In the face of looming catastrophe, climate and otherwise, we don't know whether to double down on hope or give up hope completely. We're not hopeful because things like the facts are pretty hopeless. But we're not hopeless either because, well, we love life and have a heart that still beats, and some part of us will always remain an irrepressible hope machine. It's a paradox, but that's how we do. And so we need a strategy. We need a way to walk this paradoxical path, a way to twin our warring selves. So what kind of hope can still serve us? As there are many kinds. And then based on my conversations and my reading of the literature, I identify four kinds and more beyond that, but four basic kinds. Passive hope, heroic hope, stoic hope, and grounded hope. And here's quick little summaries of each. Passive hope is super positive, almost Pollyanna-ish. It naively trusts that technology will fix things, or that since the Earth's climate has changed before, we'll be fine. The basic attitude here is don't worry, be happy, because somehow it's all going to work out. Now, this can give you more peace of mind, but it leaves little reason to act. So then, heroic hope is also similarly hyper-optimistic, but it is far more action-oriented. It lives by the credo, the best way to predict the future is to invent it. You know, a very Silicon Valley attitude, if you will. It takes a yes, we can. There's no limit to human ingenuity. Just do it attitude. Now, despite the striking differences between passive and heroic hope, they share one important quality. They both depend on results. And when actual outcomes turn sour and dark, or even sometimes just threaten to, this kind of optimism-based hope can quickly curdle, could quickly crumble and turn into pessimism. Now, hey, reality promised me that things would work out and they didn't. So, wow, why should I believe in anything anymore? You know, kind of thing. And that's very fragile. So we should, and given the circumstances that we've covered earlier in this call, we should expect any hope that depends on results to get crushed by objective reality, given what we've already baked into the atmosphere. So now what? Well, fortunately, we have two other kinds of hope to turn to. Stoic hope, which says we can handle it. We've survived tough times before. Whatever happens, we can make it through. We can rebuild. Unfortunately, Stoic hope, though sturdy and resilient, is not particularly proactive or strategic. And we need to be both right now. Enter grounded hope. This kind of hope embraces the full paradox of our predicament. It says, yes, it's hopeless, and I'll give it my all anyway. This kind of hope is not dependent on outcomes, nor attached to optimism or pessimism. Instead, it's grounded in our character and our calling. It recognizes the full difficulty of our situation, yet still chooses to be hopeful. Grounded hope channels the pivotal insight of Václav Havel, the first president of Czechoslovakia, famous playwright. Hope is an orientation of the spirit, an orientation of the heart. It is not the conviction that something will turn out well, but the certainty that what you're doing makes sense, regardless of how it turns out. Grounded hope offers us no guarantee that we will ever walk out of the darkness, but it shows us how to walk through it. Here one simply does what is right and what is necessary, and the doing and the walking are their own reward. It recalls what we were talking about earlier, Tim DeChrister's understanding of hope as the will to hold on to our values in the face of difficulty. There's much more to say, but that's a lot right there.
That is. It's like, how do we hope in a way that is grounded and useful? Because a lot of people are looking at these sort of false solutions. Oh, they're going to invent a way to pull all the carbon out of the atmosphere. The scientists are going to invent this or that or that. Oh, green hydrogen, all these sort of inventions, a lot of them probably created by the fossil fuel industries to lure us into thinking that, you know, everything's just going to be fine. So we need to really look at what's happening clearly with clear eyes and still see it. One of the things that I think of, and I think Robin Wall Kimmerer, who you also interviewed, would probably agree with this, is to just love the world so much. Love it so much that it's contagious.
Yeah, look, that's a very beautiful thing. She was an extraordinary person to sit down with and interview. You know, we did that in the Adirondack State Park in upstate New York, the biggest state park east of the Mississippi, and in a cabin with a fire going. And, you know, in her sort of, she has this great institute in upstate New York. So it's in her realm. And as you said, I have all these various charts and graphs, and not the usual kind of charts and graphs, like very unusual and playful and deeply philosophical, if you will, spiritual, existential charts and graphs in the book. But it includes this one quote that I always read out to everybody at the events I've been doing from Robin Wall Kimmerer that speaks to what you're saying. And it's a tiny, and I'll just share it because it speaks to exactly what you're saying, and probably also to art, nature, and humanity all at once. But she says, "Even a wounded world holds us, giving us moments of wonder and joy." This always makes me crack up a little bit. "I choose joy over despair because joy is what the earth gives me daily, and I must return the gift." That's Robin Wall Kimmerer laying down just extraordinary wisdom that we can take to heart. Even if we are damaging the planet, that is a spiritual attitude towards even our damaged planet. It's like, that's what this book is looking for, is not pretending things are going to be better than they are, but how do we make the best of, you know, the bad outcomes to come? And that's Robin Wall Kimmerer channeling how to be in as beautiful harmony as we can with even an earth that we have, even to some degree, permanently damaged. So it's heavy medicine.
It is, but it's laced with joy and beauty and gratitude.
Absolutely.
So one of the things a lot of people, and I can fall into this easily, is to fall into the us and them kind of thinking, which, well, is it their fault? You know,
yep.
The fossil fuels are doing that, and the people are saying there's not even a problem, and now they don't want to even support ESGs, and now they're saying it's woke, and you can easily fall into this like us and them. And of course, a lot of people profit by getting us into that conflicted place of throwing stones at each other. But there's another way that you talk about in this that keeps coming up to the surface in your writing, which is about building community and bringing things to that level of regional and local and building community. So you want to talk about that?
Yes. And about the us and the them, I'll just note that there's a chapter title that tries to take that up in a funny and way that holds the, you know, sits us in the dilemma. And it's riffing off of the famous Pogo quote, you know, that about the Vietnam War of we've met the enemy and he is us kind of thing. So we have met the enemy and he is us. No, them, but also us, but mostly them, you know. And so it sort of just navigates through that dilemma. And there's quoting different people who are, you know, saying, no, 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 it's these bad actors. No, 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 we're all implicated in this. You know, we have to change, you know, the whole operating system of humanity. It's not going to change by blaming other people, back and forth. No, 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 but look, the fossil fuel companies knew 50 years ago and they did nothing and they cast doubt on the scientific consensus around this and delayed action. So it sort of navigates that in a funny way, in a factual way, you know, holding up these two different perspectives side by side and eventually weighing in on quoting one rainforest activist saying, you know, I'm asking him, put a number on it. What percentage is it of them and what percentage is it us? And, you know, and he's like, it's 98% them. And then and I don't know if it's exactly 98% them, but it's a lot more them than it is us. And he says, but people have really fine-tuned bullshit detectors. So it's very important to do all of the 2% that we can do. And then in another piece, I asked the question, I don't know if this is allowed on podcast, but the question, there's another piece called why the fuck am I recycling? It gets into that question when the problem is so much bigger than, you know, whatever happens to all that recycling as we put it out there. Anyway, so where I land on some of this is it's absolutely essential that we do everything that we can at the individual level. We need to recycle. We need to bike more. If we're going to buy a car, get a hybrid or an electric, or we can put solar on our roof and we can afford to do that. And the regulations in our state are conducive to that as opposed to some other states where the utilities have a grip on the regulatory framework, then do so, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But while acknowledging that is insufficient, while acknowledging that is necessary, both as a spiritual practice, as a way to stay in alignment with our values, as a way to model good behavior, as to learn everything we can about what it means or what are the challenges of trying to walk your talk. You know, you need to do that. That's a spiritual practice. It's also pragmatic. Wow, I couldn't put solar on my roof because the regulations in my state don't incentivize it in a way that I can afford it. So now I'm going to join this coalition of people trying to change the regulations so that solar is incentivized. You know, you're learning things. For all those reasons, we got to do all the things at the individual level, but while noting that it is profoundly insufficient because it's the fossil fuel companies and their political handmaidens who want us to think that it's on us, right? They have done this. They knew, they hid that information, and they made it very, very, very difficult to solve the problem. And we needed to do this 30 years ago, and they made it impossible. So they're the greatest criminals in human history, arguably, given the consequences. They knew, they failed to act. Their own grandchildren will be living in a hellscape, possibly, because of their wanting to burn as much as they possibly could and make as much money as they possibly could before somebody wrapped their wrist and told them to stop. That's just a horrific, horrific crime. So we don't want to let them off the hook. We don't want to pretend that didn't happen. You know, it's on all of us to solve this problem nonetheless. So there's a lot of contradictions in all this, and we have to embrace all those contradictions to get the best, least worst outcomes we can right now.
How do you live this kind of decade, this most important decade of climate change without dealing with contradictions? Because they're everywhere. It's a cognitive dissonance is just sort of off the map, really. Let's take a short break, and we'll be right back in a moment with more with Andrew Boyd and I Want a Better Catastrophe. Stay tuned. In case you're just joining us, this is Aspire with Osha, Art, Nature, Humanity, and I'm your host, Osha Hayden. I am here with Andrew Boyd, and we are talking about his book, I Want a Better Catastrophe, Navigating the Climate Crisis with Grief, Hope, and Gallows Humor. A pretty topical book, I would say. So we were just talking about the us and them thinking. We can talk a little bit more about that, and then I also want to pivot to how we show up at the end as we're sliding down this very slippery slope. How do we show up? How does humanity show up? What is the gift that we have embodied? But let's go back to what we were just talking about, and we can kind of weave that one in.
I think they're all connected. Yeah, I'll do my best. I think, first of all, we use these metaphors of decline or going down or falling off a cliff or whatever. And I think it's important. You know, metaphors can change your life. You know, metaphors become invisibly sort of take on almost the reality. They shape how we think, how things are. And so this notion, I think, that we all have that we're going off a cliff, right? And was challenged by many of the people I interviewed. As Adrienne Marie Brown said, we're in for a hard fall. But that's not just going straight off a cliff and there's nothing to be done and this train is on a track and it's all over. And it has so much momentum that we can't stop it and whatever. You know, there's a joke in the book, we're not going off a cliff, just over a sharp, slippery slope that will wreck us, you know, kind of thing. So yes, that's a joke, but it's also a shift in metaphor, if you will. And Tim DeChristopher, who we talked about a little earlier, was saying that he thinks is one of the real psychological blocks that people think it's either we're okay, we should just business as usual, or we're going off a cliff. There were these binary extremes. But many people I talked to talked about this staged descent. You know, we're going to hit some crises. We're going to hit some ecological limits. They're going to have economic impacts. There's going to be some contractions. We might have brownouts. There will be some food shortages. Prices will go up in various ways. And we don't know all the ways it's going to play out. We know some of the ways. Some regions will be in drought. Some regions may be uninhabitable. There'll be climate refugees. We'll have to absorb them or figure out morally how we feel, you know, about addressing that. There'll be political battles around that. There'll be all sorts of things, but it won't go from, you know, 100 to zero, right? It's going to be a staged descent with bumps and plateaus and bumps and plateaus. And so the metaphor there is not a train going off a cliff and there's nothing to be done, but rather a canoe navigating some treacherous rapids, that we go through a patch of rapids and then there's a little lull and then there's another patch and that kind of thing. And so that story, and I think that's more accurate to how it's going to play out, but that story has agency, right? There's places we can get our paddle in to steer away from the worst, you know, eddies that might tip us over. And then there'll be breathing moments where we stabilize and to catch our breath and then for another until we hopefully hit a stretch of calm and clear water that maybe, I don't know, that's decades, that's generations, that's a century in the future, you know, where we have learned to live. We've been humbled. We've been through a civilizational trauma, but where we've adapted at all these stages to live in a more humbled, harmonious balance with the natural world that we depend on in a more regenerative way. And instead of 8 to 9 to 10 billion people, there's 2 billion people. But it's more of how we are living, not so much how many. And so that's just a powerful metaphor, that a shift in the story we're telling ourselves that gives us agency, possibility. We're in maybe different canoes. Some of ours canoes are stronger and others are more vulnerable and leakier, but we're going down the same rapids together as best we can. So how do we show up? We show up in that story as opposed to a story of I'm going to party till it's 2099 because it's all over, or the story of doom, or the story of I'm going to get all that I can and damn the consequences. So we show up in the story of like acknowledging the truth of the situation. We're in for this tough ride, but there's some agency we have, and it's absolutely essential that we navigate it well for the future of the species, for the future of life on Earth. For our own moral integrity.
You know, I live in Sonoma County, California, and twice we have been evacuated for 9 days at a time because the fires were coming so close to our houses and took some houses in our community close. So we're living with that. And it was a wake-up call, really. 2017, when the big fire came and all these people lost their homes, and I think there were like 100 fires at once coming from all directions.
Yeah, it's not just happening in Africa. It's not just happening in New Orleans or on the, you know, it's happening in our heartlands of our country, in our own communities.
It is. And it'll be coming soon to a theater near you.
Yeah. Right. Right. There you go. Look at you channeling Gallo's humor. Ba-dung, boom.
It seems like there's some things we need on this journey, right? We need humor. We need a lot of love. There was a quote that I really loved by Cornel West. It said, "Justice is what love looks like in public."
That's really beautiful. And Joanna Macy also said, well, we may be much closer to an outbreak of sanity than we realize.
It's possible, you know, in spite of all the doom scrolling.
Yeah. One of your graphs shows coming down like the descent, but then there's at a certain point, it's like it kind of curves back up a little bit.
Yeah.
Certain things happen, it curves back up a little bit and, you know, so that it rests at an area much above the worst.
Yes, exactly. And that's what we were talking about, sort of the in the metaphor of the canoe going down the rapids, that sort of calm water where we've taken some hits, but we've learned to adapt with a much more regenerative relationship with the natural world on which we depend. You know, no longer believing in the myth of infinite growth on a finite planet, but rather living within our means, and we're making up for what we might have to set aside on like piles of consumer goods and McMansions and stuff, and realizing that actually, you know, community and making art, as you say, in your subtitle once again, there are different kinds of joys. And there's many of these economic strategies and maps into the future that are worked out that less is actually more. It's not a giving up. It's actually a gaining a world that we've always wanted, right? Which is where we have more time for our families, more time for our communities. We're taking care of each other. We're letting nature breathe. We're not hounding after the latest gimmick. You know, we're not fast fashion. Like, we're not changing outfits three times a week, you know, buying new outfits. I think Jane Fonda she said, this is the last sweater I'm ever going to wear, kind of thing, you know? And yeah, she doesn't have, you know, maybe those of us who are a little bit younger than Jane Fonda will have two or three sweaters, but we don't need 100 sweaters. And so the promise of this is not some kind of punishment. The promise is that we can actually, again, I keep wanting to use the word solve, but it's not solving the problem. We can stumble our way to this better place, and it's actually a better place. Objectively, you know, it's actually better for us, and what brings out our best selves and our best kind of community, not the one we've been trained to think we need and want.
I think that at this stage of the collapse, if you talk to people and ask if they're really willing to give up anything, most people are not willing to give up anything that they want because they want what they want. But I think we can begin to shape what it is that we want away from what we've been trained and told that we want, what we've been sold the idea of what we want, to what we really, truly, deeply want. And that's a really different thing. It's like, you know, I might look at a donut or some cheesecake or something and go, oh, I want that. But then if I really think about it, does my body want all that fat and that lard and that sugar in it? No, it doesn't. How about an apple?
How about an apple?
How about an apple?
Yeah.
Oh, that's what got us in trouble in the first place. Oh, sorry.
All right, there you go. Uh-oh. Danger, Will Robinson. Danger.
There's a difference between the apple in the Christian story and Sky Woman in Robin Wall Kimmerer's story.
Yeah, beautiful juxtaposition of paradigms that she brings forward in her book and in the interview.
So I think what I really want to say here to my listeners, that I know you've probably been feeling this climate anxiety and some despair and some depression, and I know it hurts your heart to see what is happening to our world. And the idea of really facing up to where we are is hard. But at the same time, we as a people, we as humanity, have that which is within us, that spirit that is within us, that love that's within us, that we can navigate this in a way that makes it better. And who wouldn't want to be their best possible self at the end of humanity, right? That's in your book as well.
Yeah. I spoke with this notion of who did I speak with, and the way I referred to it, you know, riffing off of Gurdjieff's spiritual travels, I spoke with remarkable hopers and doomers. So there were some people who would be considered doomers, including scientist Guy McPherson. Even he feels like there's no way through this. This is a terminal situation. that we foisted on ourselves just due to habitat disruption is sort of his focus. Even he, with that prognosis, says, even at the end, you know, even if we're the last of our species, let's be the best of our species. So most people will disagree that we are the last of our species in any sort of short-term, near-term human extinction kind of way. But that's his perspective. But even then, there's an ethical way to do that. There's a spiritual way to do that. There's a kind way to do that. But important distinction between, you know, people say it's the end of the world. And then the distinction is that it's the end of the world as, yes, it's not the end of the world. It's the end of the world as we know it. In a sense, it's the end of capitalism. We don't know what's going to replace capitalism. It could be worse. It could be better. But it's the end. The capitalist operating system is ecocidal. And, you know, it's going to hit the limits and it can't continue. So it's the end of the world as we know it. And that's very scary. You hold on to what you know. You've made it work for yourself. And so then it requires radical imagination to imagine what other world there could be. How can we imagine that better world? And that's where Adrienne Marie Brown comes in with her visionary fiction and her... She talks about social change work as science fictional behavior. She works with groups to try to rekindle their imagination, which is an act of strategy, right? One's not left brain and right brain. There need to be twins. So, yeah. So how do we be our best selves and how do we imagine a better world given that this one is unsustainable and is in a somewhat of a death spiral now that will hurt us, but we don't have to be attached to that system. We have to just be attached to each other. And getting through the collapse of that system to something better, something that's hard for us to sort of imagine. Both the falling apart and the getting to the better place are both hard to imagine, and it's important to do that imagination work. The book does some of that, and the people I talk to do even more of that. So
I'd like to close with this quote from Wendell Berry that's in your book. "We don't have a right to ask whether we're going to succeed or not. The only question we have a right to ask is, what's the right thing to do? What does this earth require of us if we want to continue to live on it?" Wendell Berry. So people can find you, Andrew, at
the book's website, bettercatastrophe.com.
Bettercatastrophe.com.
If you're not sure you want to buy this, you can just read samples of the book there. Decide to buy. There's one of these graphics that we were talking about, these very intricate existential journey through our predicament. You can download that, some of the interesting charts and graphics there. You can see where I'm going to be appearing in these next weeks and months. And a lot of it is going to be in California, actually, and on the West Coast. The whole tour schedule and RSVP links to the events are all there as well. So bettercatastrophe.com.
I will look that up and maybe I can find you out there.
Fantastic. Thank you. I look forward to keeping up the conversation.
Yes. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Absolutely.
This is such an important topic that I think addresses something that we've been feeling, almost everyone. So kudos to you.
Thank you for having me on here. And thank you to everyone listening today.
And again, it's Andrew Boyd. I Want a Better Catastrophe: Navigating the Climate Crisis with Grief, Hope, and the All-Important Gallows Humor. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Andrew, for coming on the show. And
thank
to
you.
My listeners, have an inspired week and live your joy. It's still out there.